Greetings. This is online editor Tim Lukak with Mythbusters, Klaus Brunn, and Rainer Kurz for part two of a discussion on energy storage systems. Klaus is director of R&D at Elliott Group, and Rainer is manager of gas compression engineering at Solar Turbines. Thanks for joining me again, guys.
Thank you very much, Tim, and it's a pleasure to be on with you.
Yeah, Tim, thanks for the kind introduction and happy to be here.
What would you say is driving the energy storage hype, and how does it compare to things like hydrogen and coal?
I mean, the hype part is very clearly driven by the need to decarbonize our energy economy, right? So there is an identified desire to reduce carbon emissions into the atmosphere. And so the world has decided that we need to decarbonize energy. You can do that in multiple ways. One is to use energy sources that do not produce carbon in the first place, i.e. hydropower, nuclear power, which are the conventional non-carbon energy sources, or solar and wind. And once you start moving strongly into solar and wind, then you are stuck with the conundrum that you have a non-reliable supply that needs to be balanced. You can balance that with the existing infrastructure, meaning that you then provide some load swings with your natural gas or with whatever other energy supply you have, or you have to put, if you determine that we need to go 100% solar and wind, then you really need some tremendous amount of storage in your energy supply system. The one thing that's easily overlooked there is that fossil fuel is available, will be available for a long time. We're not talking tens of years, but we're talking about fossil fuel is available for hundreds of years. And I'm not ignoring coal here either. Coal is there. Natural gas is there. We're far from what they call peak oil. We have identified many, many resources to produce more fossil fuels. The question is now, how much of that do we want to pump into the atmosphere? And if that's becoming our limiting factor, then the alternative solution is carbon capture and sequestration. So you can take your natural gas and continue to produce electricity with it and utilize it in various ways, chemical, domestic, heating, etc. You then have to do something with your CO2.
That's very interesting. Klaus, who do you think is the low-hanging fruit in this scenario?
The low-hanging fruit there is obviously large power plants, because those give you an opportunity to either in a pre-combustion or post-combustion process to capture the CO2, compress it into a pipeline and store it in a geological formation. So that's an alternative. But the current hype for energy storage is justified very simply by decarbonization needs of the energy industry. And if we continue to build out solar and wind, which that's the current trend worldwide, not just in the US, but in Europe and other places, we will need storage, because there is no way to have a system that allows you to provide energy in a reliable manner without storage. You can always make the argument, yes, I can improve my grid, meaning I'm going to transport my electricity further away if I don't have a need for it locally. Rainer mentioned that there's only so far you transport electricity before it becomes very inefficient.
Could you explain exactly what you mean by that?
Because distribution losses are fairly high, and that's why it's generally considered to be cheaper to transport energy in a physical form, such as a liquid or natural gas.
Since we're sort of segueing into natural gas, Rainer, do you have anything you'd like to add to this discussion?
First of all, there are other ways of making hydrogen from fossil fuels, for example, by pyrolysis, which may resolve some of the CO2 sequestration issue. Quite frankly, we have to also see that if the nuclear power folks would find ways of convincingly store their nuclear waste, then they certainly would have a energy source that is independent of weather and that does not create CO2.
Everybody's talking about energy storage, but if you really look at where a lot of the industry money is invested, it is actually still in the fossil fuel energy infrastructure. If you look at the number of liquid natural gas LNG facilities that are being built in the world, that is significant. So there is a hype. We've gone through careers where hypes, there was IGCC, there was clean coal, there was hydrogen probably 15 years ago, then there was hydrogen 30 years ago. So you go through these things, there's certainly nothing wrong with it.
What can you say about the obstructive cost of energy storage systems?
energy storage has to move to price ranges where it is realistic, where it doesn't hit the cost of electricity so much that people will refuse to use it. If that's the case, energy storage is not viable. Currently, energy storage at least doubles the cost of electricity that is being produced in the United States. And the entire argument of if it comes from a curtailed energy source, being wind and solar, and you can't at that time not use that energy anyway, so you may as well store it, that argument only holds partly. Because if I run a wind turbine, I'm not getting paid for the electricity I'm producing. I'm just going to shut my wind turbine down because my wind turbine, the more it runs, the more maintenance it requires. So as an operator of a field of wind turbines, unless you pay me my electricity, I'm not producing. I'm shutting down.
Well, how does solar compare then?
A little less so with solar, but unfortunately, solar is even less at desirable times than wind turbines. Most of the solar is produced in the middle of the day, which actually surprisingly doesn't 100% correspond to the peak demand. And peak supply here is actually somewhere around 12 or 1 o'clock in the afternoon. The entire concept of free energy being curtailed energy is a little bit misleading. Plant operators will not provide free electricity. I mean, if you don't get paid for it.
I do wonder how this discussion is evolving in the industry as a whole.
I've now heard that in a number of conferences that I went to in the last 6 or 8 months or so. Initially, the big discussion almost everywhere, okay, how do we become carbon neutral? Right now, the big discussion is, okay, how do we become carbon neutral? But more importantly, how do we provide energy security? And that, of course, has started with the events in Europe, only because it all of a sudden made people aware that you can't necessarily automatically take for granted that if you turn on the light switch, that actually you will have electricity. That has really got a lot of people thinking on how do we manage renewable energy.
What do you think are the most important things when talking about energy?
People demand reliable, that's the most important thing, reliable energy. They demand cheap energy. And now the third factor that's becoming is they demand clean energy. But it's basically that order. If they turn your electricity off at your house, you're going to be screaming. If they double your price, you'll be screaming, but probably not quite as loud. And if it's clean, that's nice. So that's the priority. It's reliable, cheap, and clean. And if clean doubles your cost of electricity, then it's a problem. And if clean can impact the reliability because you're shutting down other energy sources. You have to remember that if you are setting up a system where alternative energy sources are preferred over conventional energy sources, that will ultimately lead to a situation in which fossil fuel power plants are not being built or even being shut down. And that will ultimately lead to your energy security isn't assured. But nobody's going to run a gigawatt combined cycle natural gas power plant or build one of those plants if they don't have any assurances that they're going to be running and producing electricity. And so current situation is almost funny in the sense that somebody builds a gigawatt solar field and then somebody builds a combined cycle power plant. The guy who runs the solar energy field, he has pretty much assured that he will sell every single kilowatt hour that he produces no matter what. But the guy who's running his natural gas combined cycle plant, he just has to kind of hope that in 10 years or 15 years, he can still sell electricity. So that discourages the investment in conventional energy. And that will eventually lead to a situation where you have a lot of that solar and wind stuff. There is no storage capacity in the system that will assure you that you'll actually have reliable energy.
What are some other factors to consider when talking about the cost of electricity?
Don't just assume that just the cost is affected. We all know that cost of alternative energy in the long term is more expensive. People don't like to admit to it. They say solar is cheap, wind is cheap. Reality, the total energy cost is expensive and it is, you know, subsidized and therefore it's reasonable. But it will eventually also impact energy reliability. And that's really what hurts you, not just domestic people, but you have an industry, you're producing something, you're making cars, you're making widgets. And if you lose power during the day for 2 hours and you have to shut down your production, you're going to be very, very unhappy. So these are a lot of factors that are very complicated that need to be considered when making decisions that are made by policymakers that have a very strong impact then on the technical side. And very often the technical side is overlooked.
What is the California duck curve?
Since I'm in California, I'm actually direct, if you will, beneficiary or victim of the duck curve. We always think about electric grids in the US as something that's vastly interconnected, but it really isn't. There are a couple of different areas, California is one of them, that are not terribly well connected to other areas. If you have in a region or for a grid, the vast majority or a large part of your electricity generated by renewables, then you're at the mercy of when the sun shines and the wind blows. And in particular, the sun, to some extent also the wind, behave in a predictable pattern. And I see that, for example, if I look at, I have solar cells on my roof, so I can tell you that from 9 o'clock in the morning to about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm producing electricity like there's no tomorrow. But if I have a grid that has to absorb that electricity that I produce from solar power, if that grid has to be stable, then fossil-fired plants have to reduce their capacity during that time because otherwise I make too much electricity. Now, when I come home from work, all of a sudden I want to run all sorts of things. So all of a sudden the demand starts to come up. But at the same time, my renewable sources actually start to tamper down a little bit because the sun is about to set. Now I have to bring all these fossil-fired power plants online really quick to follow the demand curve because my renewable powers can't do that. So that generates this duck curve that has a very marked imbalance between the electricity that I produce from renewables and the demand curve that I have to then compensate with fossil-fired power plants. So the duck curve is essentially, if I run on renewable energies, I unfortunately make a lot of energy when I don't need it.
So it's really an issue of highlighting the problematic nature of relying too much on renewable energy.
It's interesting because it is kind of representative for many places in the world, but it is somewhat extreme in California because of the daily cycle that people go through and also the daily supply that you have with solar and wind, a fairly significant imbalance. Interestingly, other places in the world, that supply and demand difference, let's say in Central Europe, is not quite as drastic because you don't have the high solar part, you have more of a wind, which tends to be a little more distributed in your energy mix. Demand curves are also not quite as driven by people coming home or waking up in the morning and running showers and air conditioners. But the fundamental problem is that there is an imbalance between supply and demand. There's always been an imbalance between the supply and demand. I mean, we call that baseload power, we call that peaker power. That's never changed, right? I mean, the demand has always been changing. But in the traditional energy supply system that we have throughout the world, we basically have a number of plants that are running steady all the time. Those are kind of your nuclear power plants and your hydropower plants. And then you have a certain number of plants, but they're called your intermediate power peakers, basic plants that come in a couple times in the year or run for a couple of months. And then you have your peaker plants, which are basically plants that run for a couple hours, turn on and off each day. All of that is now completely mixed up with a very unpredictable supply that makes it a lot harder for the fossil powers peaker plants to figure out when they come on and when they cannot come on. So the idea with energy storage then is to basically use energy storage to replace peaker power plants. That's the idea. The problem is that we're looking at an infrastructure that doesn't exist at this point in time, a very expensive infrastructure that has to be paid for, and also, unfortunately, an infrastructure that is very lossy in that its efficiency is well below 60 or 70%. If you look at mechanical thermal type energy storage, and even with battery storage, it's, you know, in the 80s to 90% efficiency range, if you include all the losses, transmission losses to the where the battery storage is, etc. Fundamentally adding a lot of cost.
Rainer, would you add your thoughts on how this affects the maintenance and repair aspect of fossil-fired power plants?
You have to actually be aware that any fossil-fired power plant will have more wear and tear if you run it cyclic rather than running it steady state. So that's true for nuclear power plants, but it's also true for any other power plant that thermal cycling from a material, from a maintenance standpoint, is not your friend.
We are looking at a little bit of a conundrum here, because obviously energy demand, electricity demand in the United States increases. The United States population is increasing still. Over the last 30 years, we've had an increase of about 50 million people or so. And so as your population grows, as people have better air conditioners, more air conditioners, bigger houses, bigger cars, so does your energy demand in the country grow. We also now seeing more electric vehicles, so there will be a draw on your electricity supply system as we are supposedly transitioning over to electric vehicles in the next 15 to 20 years that will require significantly more electric infrastructure. On the other hand, we're discouraging the build-out of fossil fuel power plants because we're not providing any guarantees that you can actually sell your electricity. And we're encouraging alternative energy sources. So that then will drive more and more this need for energy storage. Right now, very few utilities or independent power producers are interested in building gigawatt-size fossil fuel power plants because there is no guarantee that you're going to be selling your electricity in 15 to 20 years from now. These plants cost $1 billion plus, typically in the couple billion dollar range. And you're not going to make a couple billion dollar investment into something that you don't know is going to guarantee you a revenue stream. We're seeing more of a build out of the alternative side, but it leads us to the situation where it will impact our reliability of our system.
That concludes this episode of the Turbo Time podcast with our special guests, Klaus Brunn and Rainer Kurz. I'm online editor Tim Lukak, and we hope you enjoyed this insightful and informative conversation about energy storage technologies in the industry. It's been a pleasure to have Klaus and Rainer share their knowledge and expertise on the show today.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the discussion, and I'm looking forward for more interesting discussion in our next podcast.
Same here. And as you can see, we are very enthusiastic about discussing these things because we're dealing with it on a daily basis. So I really appreciate having the opportunity to talk about things that we're really passionate about.